From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Charles Darwin was born 200 years ago. His theory of evolution revolutionized the modern world and demolished the age-old argument that God created life on Earth, or so it seemed. And yet half of all Americans still believe the biblical story of creation, according to a recent Pew poll. Only a quarter believe the theory of evolution. These numbers leave a lot of scientists mystified and, quite frankly, angry. Atheist Richard Dawkins believes the raging debate over evolution points to an even bigger problem.
If you think, as I do, that the war is between supernaturalism and naturalism, then the war over the teaching of evolution is just one skirmish, just one battle in the war.
So is Darwinian evolution compatible with faith in God? Today we'll hear more from Richard Dawkins, and we'll also find out what Darwin himself thought as we visit Cambridge University to get a first-hand look at Darwin's letters, and an evolutionary biologist who rejects both biblical creationism and the standard account of evolution.
This argument between science and religion I see as absolutely unnecessary. We could do the same kind of good technical science research, and it wouldn't spoil anything in science.
But first, philosopher Daniel Dennett, one of the leading advocates of evolutionary theory and a fierce critic of creationism. In his book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, he makes the case that evolution is like a universal acid, an idea so radical that it eats away everything it touches. Steve Paulson asked Dennett to explain what he means.
The idea of universal acid was the idea of an acid that could eat through anything. So what on earth could you keep it in? You couldn't keep it in glass because it could eat through glass just the way it could eat through a tin can. And then it occurred to me that there's a certain sense in which Darwinism is an idea like that, that really does turn everything upside down. Before Darwin, we had the idea, and people still have it, of course, that it takes a big, fancy, smart thing to make a less intelligent thing. You never see a pot making a potter. You never see a horseshoe making a blacksmith. And along comes Darwin and says, it doesn't have to be that way. We can turn the process upside down. We can have a process of natural selection, which itself has no intelligence, has no foresight, and it just mechanically sifts and sorts and sifts and sorts. It's just a brute mechanical process. And over time, if certain conditions are met, out of this unintelligent process will emerge creation.
But you're saying that what that does, I mean, that notion of Darwinism, it does away with the creator. I mean, there's no place for a creator in Darwin's theory of evolution.
That's right. There is no place for an intelligent creator. The work that an intelligent creator would have to do can be done by the process of natural selection. Our species, Homo sapiens, we're mammals, we're products of evolution, and our brains are material organs. There's no such thing as an immortal soul, as a separate immaterial entity. That's a fragile myth that science can't support at all.
You're saying if you accept evolution by natural selection, the soul goes out the window because there's no way to account for the evolution of the soul.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Or let me put it slightly differently, because my own work, of course, on consciousness and the brain has particularly dealt with this problem. And an Italian journalist interviewed me, and the paper ran a wonderful headline, "Yes, we have a soul, but it's made of lots of tiny robots." And I thought, that's brilliant. That's exactly my position. Yeah, we do have a soul. That is to say, human beings are different from all other species. We are the moral animal. We are the ones whose minds have the sorts of complexities that make us morally responsible in a way that no dog or bear or chimpanzee or dolphin even is responsible. But this is itself a perfectly natural phenomenon. It evolved. We can explain it evolutionarily.
Why is evolution the hot spot in the science and religion debate? I mean, why doesn't quantum physics inspire this kind of controversy, or artificial intelligence?
It's interesting. I think that artificial intelligence would inspire very much the same anger, and in some quarters it does. It's just not well enough known or believed in. But why has this confrontation over evolution not died away a long time ago. I don't think I know. I don't think anybody knows. It's a bit of a scandal that we don't know why creationism should maintain its popularity in the face of 150 years of just stunningly successful biology. And yet the hostility and the ignorance of evolutionary biology is just breathtaking, and it's spreading.
Philosopher Daniel Dennett speaking with Steve Paulson. His latest book is called Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon.
I don't believe that we actually descended from apes.
I do not believe that in any way, shape, or form we descended from apes.
I didn't believe that till I met my uncle who had more back hair than I have facial hair, so yeah, I kind of believe that now.
That's a scene from the documentary film Flock of Dodos. The man who made the film, Randy Olson, has a few thoughts on why evolutionary thinking has run into so much resistance. He says it's because of the arrogance of scientists. Now, I should point out that Olson is himself a scientist, a Harvard-trained evolutionary biologist who's firmly in the camp of evolutionary theory. But his film ridicules the condescending attitude of scientists. It also attacks the intelligent design movement, which Olson says is riddled with contradictions.
The Mount Rushmore example that they use, they don't explain very well at times. And in fact, even in the film, Michael Behe, who's one of the main guys using that, I let him explain it. He didn't do a very good job. I went ahead and put it in there so people can see how confusing this stuff is.
If you're walking by the Rocky Mountains and somebody asked you how they got there, you'd probably just say plate tectonics or erosion or some such thing. But if you walked by Mount Rushmore and somebody asked you how that got there, you'd immediately say, well, somebody carved that. You can, by the physical features of the mountain, you can detect the effects of intelligent activity. Intelligent design is the idea these days that we can detect the effects of intelligence in life. In effect, we see Mount Rushmores in the cell.
But the idea there is that a natural mountainside, you don't see the presence of a hand at work designing it. In Mount Rushmore, suddenly you can see there is this pattern there that you can recognize. But again, it's based on our human preconceptions, and that's why I ended up with that Dover school board member as he was trying to run through Behe's presentation. And I just kept saying to him, yeah, but this is a human designer at work. You've got this hypothesis of what design looks like based on your concepts of what humans make when they make designs. Had Mount Rushmore been carved in the shape of some sort of Precambrian gelatinous organisms that we don't normally recognize, it could very well have been designed, but you'd look at it and think, well, that's not designed because it doesn't look like any creature that I know.
Well, this actually raises the other interesting point. You call your film The Flock of Dodos, and it isn't entirely clear who you mean when you're talking about that. It's not necessarily the intelligent design people, because they come off in many ways as having a strong grasp of public relations. Scientists, in your film and others, don't seem to have this same easy grasp of public relations. Is it really just that simple that scientists don't know how to tell people what they know?
Okay, 3 points relevant to this. Number one, I used to be a scientist. I got tenure as a professor at the University of New Hampshire. I used to be an academic, and I used to walk around looking at people saying, you're all stupid. And I know what that perspective is like as an academic. Then I changed my life. I moved to Hollywood, and I ended up in a 2-year acting program. And one of the things, the fundamental rules we learned in that acting program was never rise above. Whenever you rise above in any given scene, the audience will always sympathize with the person being risen above. That was ground in our heads so solidly as one of the firm basic principles of acting. And then a year ago, as I began reading about this intelligent design issue and seeing some of these blog posts where these evolutionists get on these blogs, and I mean, they're still even doing it to me. Evolutionists are writing me emails about how stupid I am with this movie, that I don't understand how this stuff works. And it's really a human constraint of academics. They get so caught up in their perspective that they develop this kind of intolerance and rising above. And that's a symptom that I saw. And I just know, as a basic fundamental principle of communication, it is not effective. And it's gone on in a lot of places. And it's gone on in Kansas, where a lot of the best evolutionists have shown up there and condescended to the general public about, you people are so stupid with all your crazy ideas here. And it's just not that simple.
Well, of course, you showed some of that off in the poker game that recurs throughout the film. There are a number of academics who get together, clearly very bright men, and also clearly people that you'd probably like. But there was a fair amount of
arrogance there as well.
Absolutely, and the arrogance was all eight members of the poker game, including myself. I mean, that is a bunch of academics for you.
This is a big controversy, because some people think the Earth was created 6,000 years ago, contrary to all the physical and geological evidence. And because a small number of people who, frankly, are yahoos, who know nothing, are ignoramuses, they really do not understand modern science. Because of that, public education is interfered with. Now, one should never mock people's religious beliefs, and I certainly don't believe in doing that. It's not my position to persuade people you shouldn't believe in God or you should believe in God. But when they come into the scientific arena and they start saying things that are manifestly wrong, that are manifestly ignorant, I think people have to stand up and say, you know, you're an idiot.
The poker game ends up being the most wonderful part of the whole film. I didn't anticipate that that attitude would arise from the thing. But a lot of that attitude is not even so much what is said during the poker game. It's how it's being said. It's the tone of voice. It's the style. It's the whole condescension of all of the people at the table. And it's very characteristic of the situation, the plight of academics today.
One of the things that's clear about your filmmaking style is that you enjoy laughing. It's pretty funny on all sides of this, and I gather that you felt it was pretty important to use humor in dealing with a serious subject.
Well, if you watch the film, you'll see that the number one star of the whole film is my mother, Muffy Moose. And in so many of the screenings, people have stood up afterwards and just said, you know, I just want to say the best character in your film is your mother. And it is true. She is a very broad-minded person. One of the things I've come to realize is there are three voices in the film. There is the intelligent designers, there's the evolutionists, and then there's Muffy Moose, who really is the voice of the broad, only semi-interested and enlightened general public. And she's the one that most people seem to connect with in the broader audience. But what's also fascinating that dawned on us just a few weeks ago is that of those three voices, only one of them is searching. The evolutionists feel they've got it all figured out. The intelligent designers feel they've got it all figured out. And all my mother keeps saying through the movie is, I have no idea what's going on. I'm still searching. I'm looking into witchcraft and UFOs and all these other sorts of crazy things. And I'm just looking for some answers. And I think that's one thing that people connect with also with her a lot. And it, of course, at the end of the film, she reveals that her newest interest is Buddhism. So she is constantly exploring, and I think a lot of people admire that.
I'm kind of thinking about studying Buddhism now, because, you know, they believe in these things. And they have a great philosophy. They have a happy philosophy. They probably have the happiest philosophy I've heard yet. So I might do a little studying on that one.
Why do you believe it?
Well, I like what they're saying about look forward to the next life. Don't agonize over death. You know, come on, let's get with the program. The flower blooms, lives, and dies, and then goes on. Where does it go? Well, I think they have a nice theory. It goes on to have another life. Yep.
A scene from the documentary film Flock of Dodos. I talked with the film's creator, evolutionary biologist Randy Olson. Is evolution compatible with faith in God? The question's been debated ever since Charles Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, and it may be the only point that today's creationists and atheists agree on. Both say evolution leaves no room for God. But what did Darwin himself think? To find out, Steve Paulson talked with some leading Darwin experts and made his own pilgrimage to see Darwin's letters at Cambridge University in England.
Charles Darwin not only made one of history's great discoveries, he underwent his own dramatic struggle with faith. Like many proper Victorians, Darwin grew up a devout Anglican, but by the end of his life he'd come to call himself an agnostic. What caused this transformation isn't entirely clear, though his faith started to slip during his long voyage on board the Beagle.
Darwin departed England, a devout Bible literalist.
The eminent biologist Edward O. Wilson, who recently put out a new edition of Darwin's major books.
He had, in fact, trained as a minister at Cambridge University. And as he says in his autobiography, he even would pull out the Bible to settle some argument or try to settle it with other members of the ship's crew, and that they laughed at him because he would quote the Bible.
What happened in the 1830s, when he was in his 20s, he did spend 5 years on board HMS Beagle going round the world.
Philosopher of science Michael Ruse.
And it's pretty clear that during that time, his Christian faith started to fade. So at that point, he didn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God. He became what we call in the trade a deist.
There are various theories on why Darwin rejected Christianity. Years later, Darwin said his voyage on the Beagle exposed him to different religions around the world, and he came to think the biblical stories were not infallible. Biographers have also pointed to a more personal trauma, the death of Darwin's favorite daughter. How could a benevolent God permit such evil? But E.O. Wilson says there was an even more powerful reason Darwin abandoned God.
What really turned him against religion was the doctrine of damnation. He said, if the Bible is true, and you must be redeemed in Christ and be a believer in order to go to heaven and not go to hell, and others will be condemned. And he said, that includes my brothers and all my best friends. And he said, that is a damnable doctrine.
Now, it's worth pointing out that Darwin's discovery of evolution is not what turned him against religion. In fact, it's not clear that Darwin ever thought his theory of natural selection was incompatible with belief in God. But that's not the story we've heard about the origin of species.
The prevailing view is that it was a work which undermined the foundations of religious belief, and that it led to a storm of controversy in which people were divided either for or against, that it was therefore an essentially atheistic tract. And what we found through the correspondence is that there's really a much more complicated story.
That's Paul White, an editor of the Darwin Correspondence Project in England, the massive undertaking, now in its 32nd year, to collect all the letters ever written by and to Darwin. If you want to know what Darwin really thought about religion, this is the place to go. Darwin was always reluctant to say much about religion in his books, but in his letters he let down his guard every so often. Darwin's letters are among the most treasured documents in the Cambridge University Library. They are kept under lock and key. Paul White takes me into a private room where he's laid out some pivotal documents for me to see, books that Darwin owned, with his own notes scribbled in the margins, and letters written to Darwin asking if you could still be a Christian if you believed his theory of evolution.
That's from a woman who was the wife of the mathematician George Boole. She was an educator. She was a writer on religious and philosophical topics. She was also the mother of four children. And she's writing this as a widow. And she's asking for Darwin's frank opinion on certain religious questions, which are troubling her because of her position as a mother. She's never written to Darwin before. He doesn't know who she is. She says, "Will you excuse my venturing to ask you a question which no one's answer but your own would be quite satisfactory to you?" That's actually a series of questions. "Do you consider the holding of your theory of natural selection to be inconsistent with the following belief, that knowledge is given to man by the direct inspiration of the Spirit of God, that God is a personal and infinitely good being?" And she says, "The reason why I ask you is, my own impression has always been that your theory was quite compatible with the faith to which I have just tried to give expression."
So what does Darwin say in response?
He's a very polite man. He says, "It would have gratified me much if I could have sent satisfactory answers to your questions, or indeed answers of any kind, but I cannot see how the belief that all organic beings, including man, have been genetically derived from some simple being bears on your difficulties. These, as it seems to me, can only be answered by widely different evidence from science or by the so-called inner consciousness." So he's drawing clear boundaries between science and religion. From that sort of letter, it's not at all clear what Darwin personally believed, and he's very reluctant to offer his personal beliefs as a kind of model or standard by which others should live.
What's striking about this correspondence is how much his contemporaries wanted to hear directly from Darwin. There's a sense of scriptural authority. Let's hear it from the great man himself, not unlike the authority of religious texts. Not surprisingly, Darwin was asked if he was an atheist.
Well, here's what he says to an author and philosopher, John Fordyce, in 1879. "In my most extreme fluctuations, I have never been an atheist in the sense of denying the existence of a God. I think that generally, and more so as I grow older, but not always, that An agnostic would be the most correct description of my state of mind. And there are various meanings. Some people try to turn agnosticism into a religion as well, a kind of, you know, atheism by another name. But I think for Darwin, it was very much a sort of statement about his own uncertainty.
So it sounds like Darwin himself left this question entirely unresolved. I mean, it sounds like he was still wrestling with the question of God in his own life, and also the question of, does the theory of evolution displace religion? He's basically saying no.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, that's what he tells his correspondents, and that's perhaps why he wasn't able to investigate it himself. I think if he thought those answers could be discovered through science, he would have taken them on.
That's Paul White of the Darwin Correspondence Project talking with Steve Paulson at Cambridge University Library in England. What do you think about the debate over Darwin and God? You can let us know by going to our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, renowned atheist Richard Dawkins and the forgotten history of creationism. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
When I think of evolution, I think of something that man has come up with. The Big Bang Theory is something that I do not believe in. I believe God's spoken word created the world, the heavens, the earth. It says that he formed it, and it happened in 7 days.
There's scientific evidence that certain creatures have evolved, and it's hard to separate that from just everything was created in 7 days. Because it wasn't.
It's the only explanation the atheists have of this beautiful world that surrounds us. They paint the disguise as a scientific thing, which is not. And it's a big lie, it's a big blunder.
It's been proven, we can look at it, we have the science for it. I think it's very frightening for a lot of people to think that we aren't the be-all and end-all.
Our material existence could easily have been caused through evolution, through the Big Bang, let's say, and through the evolution of the universe. But then he uniquely ensouled us. And science cannot speak to the ensoulment of the human person because science can only measure the tangible, and the soul is intangible.
It's human nature to wonder. Some people want the facts, and some people just want to believe in something else. Everybody needs something to believe, I guess.
More than anyone else, the Oxford scientist Richard Dawkins has emerged as the lightning rod in the debate over evolution. Dawkins is not only a prominent biologist, author of the classic book, The Selfish Gene, he's also an outspoken atheist. His manifesto against religion is called the God Delusion. Dawkins believes evolution has shattered the foundation of religious faith. The intelligent design advocate, William Dembski, has actually thanked Dawkins for his militant atheism. In a letter to Dawkins, Dembski wrote, and I'm quoting here, "I want to thank you for being such a wonderful foil for theism and for intelligent design more generally. In fact, I regularly tell my colleagues that you and your work are one of God's greatest gifts to the intelligent design movement. So please, keep at it." Steve Paulson wanted to know, how does Dawkins respond to that?
Yeah, I get that quite a lot, because it is a very difficult political dilemma that we face. In the United States of America at the moment, science is definitely under attack, and evolution is in the frontline trench of that battle. And so a science defense lobby has sprung up, which in practice largely means an evolution defense lobby. Now, it is true that if you want to win a court case in the United States, where it's specifically on the narrow issue of should evolution be taught in the public schools, if somebody like me is called as a witness and the lawyer for the other side says something like, Professor Dawkins, is it true that you were led to atheism through your study of Darwinian evolution? I would have to answer yes. And that, of course, plays into their hands because any jury is likely to have been brought up to believe that atheists are the devil incarnate. And therefore, if Darwinism leads to atheism, then obviously we've got to throw out Darwinism. Well, that is exactly what Dembski, whom you quote, is getting at. He claims to like the things that I say because I am playing into his hands by allowing people like him to make the equation between Darwinism and atheism.
But it's not just Dembski. So I've heard this from various scientists. I mean, hardcore evolutionists who wish you would tone down your rhetoric, quite frankly.
This
hurts the cause of teaching evolution. Yeah. It just gives fire to the creationists.
Yes, they could be, in a political sense, right. It depends whether you think that the real war is the war over the teaching of evolution, as they do, or whether, as I do, think the real war is between supernaturalism and naturalism, between science and religion. If you think, as I do, that the war is between supernaturalism and naturalism, then the war over the teaching of evolution is just one skirmish, just one battle in the war. So what the scientists that you've been talking to are asking me to do is to shut my mouth, because for the sake of what I see as the war, I'm in danger of losing this particular battle. But as it happens, I think that the war is more important. I actually do care about the existence of a supreme being. I do think it is a scientific question whether the supreme being exists or not, and therefore I don't think I should say something which I believe to be false, which is that science and religion have no contact with each other. We can all get along cozily together and keep out those lunatic creationists.
Why do you think Darwinian evolution logically leads to atheism?
Well, I'm not sure it's a logical thing. I call it consciousness raising. I think the most powerful reason for believing in a supreme being is the so-called argument from design, or the argument for design. Living things in particular look complicated, look beautiful, look as though they've been designed. And therefore, it's really no wonder that before Darwin came along, just about everybody was a theist. What Darwin did was to show that that argument doesn't hold. He blew it out of the water. Darwin destroyed that argument. Although he didn't destroy the parallel argument from, say, cosmology, where did the universe come from, where did the laws of physics come from, he raised our consciousness to the power of science to explain things. So when people say, I can't see how the universe could have come into being without God, be very careful when you make that kind of argument, because you've had your fingers burned before over biology. That's the consciousness-raising sense in which Darwinism does, I think, lead towards atheism.
That's biologist Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion. So why do so many people still reject Darwinian evolution? Perhaps no one is better equipped to answer that question than University of Wisconsin historian Ronald Numbers. His book, The Creationists, is widely considered the definitive history of the anti-evolutionist movement. And Numbers himself has a unique perspective on the subject. He himself was once an ardent creationist. Steve Paulson sat down with Ron Numbers to talk about the hidden history of creationism.
There's a stereotype that creationists just aren't that smart. I mean, how can you ignore the steady accumulation of scientific knowledge that has shown overwhelming support for evolution? Is this a question of intelligence or of education?
Not fundamentally. They're really dumb creationists and they're really dumb evolutionists. I don't know that one has a monopoly at all. Of the 10 founders of the Creation Research Society, 5 of them had earned doctorates in the biological sciences from major universities. Another had a PhD from Berkeley in biochemistry, and another had a PhD from the University of Minnesota. These were not dumb, uneducated people. They were individuals who rejected evolution for religious and, they would say, for scientific reasons.
And yet that's so hard to understand for people who aren't religious. I mean, if you go through the university system, get a graduate degree in the biological sciences, how can you still allow religion to trump science?
Well, most people who reject evolution do not see themselves as being anti-scientific in any way. They love science, and they feel that creationism is scientific.
Given your field of study, you have a particularly interesting personal history. You grew up in a family of Seventh-day Adventists, right?
That's correct. All my male relatives, I believe, were ministers of one kind or another.
All? Going how far back?
Both my grandfathers. My maternal grandfather was president of the International Church. My father. All my uncles on both sides worked for the church. My brother-in-law is a minister. My nephew is a minister.
So you went through Adventist schools.
First grade through college.
Through college.
I graduated from Southern Missionary College in Tennessee.
Hmm. And what did you think about the story of life's origins as you were growing up?
I was never exposed to anything other than what we now call young earth creationism. Creation science, as you may know, came out of Seventh-day Adventism. My father was a believer. All my teachers were believers. All my friends believed in that. I can remember as a college student, I majored in math and physics, and there was a visiting professor from the University of Chicago lecturing on carbon 14 dating. And he was talking about scores of thousands of years. And my friends and I just looked at each other, wincing and smiling, and he just didn't know the truth.
But at some point, your ideas obviously changed. What caused you to start to question the creationist account?
I wish I knew. There are a few moments that I can identify that proved crucial for me. One was I went to Berkeley in the 60s as a graduate student in history and learned to read critically. Also, I was exposed to critiques of young earth creationism. And the one that stands out in my memory as being decisive was hearing a lecture about the fossil forest of Yellowstone given by a creationist who had just been out there to visit and found that of the 30 or so successive layers, you needed, assuming the most rapid rates of decomposition of lava into soil, and the most rapid rates of growth for the trees who came back in that area, you needed at least, say, 20 to 30,000 years. And he had slides. And the only alternative that the creationists had to offer for that was that during the year of Noah's flood, these whole stands of trees came floating in, one on top of another, until you had about 30 stacked up. And that truly seemed incredible to me.
So your beliefs kind of came crashing down at that moment.
Well, the night after I heard that, I stayed up till very, very late with a fellow Adventist graduate student friend of mine, wrestling with the implications of this. And before dawn, we both decided that the evidence was too strong.
Hmm. Now, you went on later to write a book about Ellen White.
I did.
About the founder of the Seventh-day Adventists. That proved to be quite controversial, right?
It did. I wrote about her as a historian would without invoking supernatural explanations. That bothered a lot of people because according to traditional Adventism, she was chosen of God who would take her into visions where she would see events past, present, and future. Once she actually, God took her back to witness the creation. And she saw that creation occurred in six literal 24-hour days, which made it impossible for most Adventists to play around with symbolic interpretations of Genesis. I also found in my research that she had been copying some of her so-called testimonies, which were supposed to be coming directly from God. So it did create something of a stir.
Well, and I would think in your own family. I mean, here you were, a child of generations of Adventists. That must have created some trouble for you.
It did. It created some trouble for my father, too.
Your father, who was a minister.
My father was a minister. Some church members were very harsh with him. Here I was, about 30 or so, and they were telling him he had no right being a minister if he couldn't control his sons. He took early retirement.
Because of your book?
Yes. He was thoroughly humiliated by this.
Did he try to talk you out of the book?
Oh, yes. We had hours and hours and hours of argument. He had limited number of explanations for why I would be saying this about the prophetess. One was that I was lying, but he knew me too well. And he says, I know, Ronnie, you're not going to lie. So the only explanation left for him was that somehow Satan had gained control of my mind. And what I was writing reflected the power of Satan. For a number of years, he could not bear to be seen in public with me if he thought any if he thought no other Adventist would see us, that was no problem. But if there were going to be Adventists around, he wouldn't go out with me.
What are your religious beliefs now?
I don't have any.
So how do you describe yourself? Are you an atheist?
I don't think so. I think that's a belief, that there's no God. After a number of years of trying to resolve these issues, I decided they're not resolvable. And so I think the term agnostic would be best for me.
You mentioned that Seventh-day Adventism actually played a crucial role in the history of creationism. An early Adventist was the one who really laid out the whole idea of flood geology, didn't he?
Exactly. George McCready Price, Ellen White's disciple, came along in the early 20th century and made the flood the key actor in the history of life on Earth. And he tried to show that the entire geological column could have been deposited in about 1 year. And that became the centerpiece of what he called the new catastrophism. And then in about 1970, that view, flood geology, the new catastrophism, was renamed creation science or scientific creationism.
But this is a fascinating history, because you're saying that this whole idea of flood geology was really laid out by George McCready Price in the 1920s.
Correct.
And then it kind of disappeared, or it sort of went underground, and then it was revived again in the 1960s.
In the early 60s, two fundamentalists, a theologian named John Whitcomb Jr. and a hydraulic engineer named Henry Morris, took Price's flood geology, reworked it a little bit, and published it as The Genesis Flood. Notice, the seminal books in the history of creationism have focused on geology and the flood, not so much on biology. And as a result of what Whitcomb and Morris did, Price's views exploded among fundamentalists and other conservative Christians.
But why? Why did this view, which on the surface seems kind of outlandish,
yes,
the idea that Noah's flood would have somehow resolved all of the contradictions within the fossil record, why would that suddenly explode in popularity in the 1960s?
And especially when fundamentalists had perfectly orthodox interpretations of Genesis 1 that would have allowed them to accept all the paleontological evidence. One was that the days of Genesis represented vast geological epochs. William Jennings Bryan accepted that.
So in that account, you could have the Earth going back billions of years.
Time was no problem. So you had these perfectly good interpretations of Genesis available to fundamentalists. Why would they accept this radical, reactionary theory that everything was created only about 6,000, 7,000 years ago?
Okay, well, I'm willing to bet that you have some explanation here.
The biggest explanation, I think, is that for 100 and some years, Christians had been reinterpreting God's sacred word, the Bible, in the light of new scientific discoveries. And people like Whitcomb and Morris, the authors of the Genesis Flood, struck a really sensitive chord when they said, it's time to quit interpreting God in the light of science and start with God's revealed word, and then see if there's any model of Earth history that will fit with that.
Because otherwise, science keeps chipping away.
Exactly. At never ends. It always changes, and it means you're going to have to constantly be reinterpreting God. And it wasn't so much that they invested in the Genesis account as that many of them were concerned about the last book of the Bible, Revelation. And they would argue, how can we expect people, Christians, to believe in the prophecies of Revelation about end times, which were so near and crucial, when we symbolically interpret Genesis? So they felt, if you want people to take Revelation seriously, you have to get them to take Genesis really seriously.
Now, one thing I find curious about your position in all of this is, I mean, you are generally acknowledged to have written the history of creationism, your book, The Creationists. You've been very upfront about your own lack of religious belief. And yet, as far as I can tell, you seem to be held in high regard by both the creationists and by scientists, which I have to say is a neat trick.
I think in terms of getting along well with critics of evolution, I haven't gone out of my way to attack them or to ridicule them. I know some of the people I've written about. They're good people. Some of them are smarter than I am, not a particularly high standard, but I know that it's not because they're stupid that they're creationists. I'm talking about all my family, too, who are still creationists. So that easy explanation that so many anti-creationists use, that they're just illiterate hillbillies, doesn't have any appeal for me.
University of Wisconsin historian Ronald Numbers talking with Steve Paulson. If you'd like to learn more about the history of creationism, you can read Steve's interview with Ron Numbers that ran in Salon magazine. You'll find a link on our website at ttbook.org.
Haven't you ever heard of Darwin? Did you think we were gonna run and hide? Haven't you ever heard of Darwin? Don't roll down your car windows. It's a jungle outside.
Coming up, a very different take on evolution. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
I didn't ditch my science at all. It was just a suit too tight fitting, and I had to expand my horizons, expand my worldviews, learn from other cultures.
That's biologist Elizabeth Sartouris, who left her teaching jobs at MIT and the University of Massachusetts, and later her work on the science show Nova, to go live on a Greek island and rethink her life as a scientist. In the years since then, Sartouris has developed a radical critique of Darwinism. I should say, Sartouris has no truck with biblical creationists, but she believes the standard story of evolution has some major problems. Anne Strainchamps wanted to know more.
Your training is in evolutionary biology, but I know you've come to see the Darwinian account of evolution as not really telling the whole story of our origins. Why do you think the standard story of evolution falls short?
Well, really, this conflict that's going on now between evolution and creationism is a broader battle between science and religion. And that, of course, goes back to when the church in Europe originally was dissatisfied with science because it had a different creation story from the church. However, when the Industrial Revolution comes along, the industrialists can really use the scientists, and so you get a new alliance between science and industry. Now, because of this alliance, Darwin has a kind of different slant on things. In particular, Darwin says in The Origin of Species that his evolutionary theory is the doctrine of Malthus applied to all aspects of nature.
Now, Thomas Malthus was the guy who decided the world was going to end soon because human populations always outstrip their food supplies. And he was the chief economist for the first great global multinational, which was the East India Company.
So are you saying that what Darwin came up with is basically an economic model of evolution?
Well, yes. Now, my problem with Darwin is not that it takes an economic view, but that the Malthusian struggle in scarcity story is the only one that Darwin picked up.
But what's wrong with that?
The problem with that is that nature turns out to be extremely intelligent from the get-go, and we now have people studying at the microbiological level and seeing how bacteria, for example, exchange information, make decisions across millions and even billions of individuals in communities so that they can reinvent themselves under stress by literally turning themselves into a different kind of bacterium in a time frame that can't be accounted for by chemical or electrical transmissions of information.
Well, so what do you think is driving this process? Because Darwin suggested that the engine driving all of this is simply accident and random mutation, and then the mutations that work, that are best for the species, are most competitive, are the ones that win out.
Probably the most important driver in evolution is stress. For example, when there's a great extinction on the planet, afterwards you see a flowering of new species that are all in the fossil record at once, as if the planet is, if it could talk about itself, was saying, boy, that didn't work. We couldn't get through that disaster. Let's try something different. The last great extinction killed off the dinosaurs and opened a path for the mammals, which had just begun to come in but weren't getting very far with all those dinosaurs stomping around and chewing them up. So now you get an era of mammalian flowering after that great extinction. And when I talked about the bacteria in the lab in Tel Aviv, they were stressed by putting them, say, on a substrate that they couldn't feed off, and they reinvented themselves. They literally chose from their own gene pool genes that had not been active, turned them into new metabolic cycles so that they could digest something they couldn't previously digest. Now, how did they do that? It happens very, very quickly because the colony dies off pretty immediately if there's no food. And yet it doesn't. It gets resourceful. It gets creative.
I want to talk a little bit more about the connection you make between biology and spirituality, because, you know, science and spirituality have been, we've regarded them as two entirely separate domains for a very long time. But when you write about the origin of the planet, the origin of the cosmos, you very often talk about the planet and the cosmos in terms of consciousness. Can you explain a bit about those ideas?
Yes. Well, when Willis Harmon asked me in the 90s to write a book with him, and we decided to call it Biology Revisioned, he asked me whether I was willing to take consciousness as the source of material evolution rather than as its late emergent product, as most scientists would say, consciousness arising from the brain, and the opposite perspective is the brain arises from consciousness. Now, that's a position that's taken by many of the Eastern philosophies or religions, depending what you call them. For instance, the Vedic, in which consciousness gives rise to the material world. Now, Western science has a foundation made up of unprovable assumptions. And the unproven assumptions of Western science are this is a non-living universe with no purpose, no designer, no intelligence, in which life happens by accidental processes that get more and more complex. So I did make that 180-degree shift, as I call it. What I'm really looking for is an integral global science that would exchange those assumptions about a non-living, purposeless universe for the Vedic assumptions, this would bring East and West together, that the universe begins in a field of consciousness. And of course, the Copenhagen interpretation in physics says that things only happen in reality when our consciousness collapses wave functions. So science is very close to this.
I don't understand why this isn't simply creationism in different garb. I mean, because you're calling it consciousness, but isn't that the same as saying a creationist saying God created the universe?
There's a very big difference between Eastern and Western religions. The Eastern religions do not have a God in the sense of the Western ones. I should call them the desert religions, which is Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. They all have an external creator God who creates the world and then can let it go or manipulate it or whatever, depending on your belief system. In the Eastern, we usually call them philosophies, there is no such personality. There is no external God. God is equivalent to nature. Nature itself is sacred. Nature itself evolves from utter simplicity of oneness to complexity, and you revere it, you commune with it.
But aren't we just quibbling over what you think God is then? I mean, whether God is sort of separate from nature or whether God and nature are the same?
You know, as a scientist, it took me a very long time to be able to say the God word. But what we need is we need to bring East and West together in an integral global science, because this argument between science and religion I see as absolutely unnecessary. We could do the same kind of good technical science research on a foundation of, let's say, the universe is in the business of creating living systems, that it's conscious, that it becomes self-reflective through evolution, and it wouldn't spoil anything in science. What it would help with is questions like, how do you get intelligence out of non-intelligence, out of dumb mud bootstrapping itself? You wouldn't have to answer that question. You wouldn't have to answer where consciousness comes from. And there's no way that humans can ever answer that question. It has to remain a mystery of unity.
Elizabeth Satouris, talking with Anne Strangechamps. Satouris is the author of Earth Dance, Living Systems and Evolution. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, we'd love to hear from you. Send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the program The Darwin Debates, number 28B. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link for the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strangechamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, and Doug Gordon. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.